COVID child neglect fears is the stark headline on the front of this morning's Irish Independent, above detail that vulnerable children are at increased risk while schools are closed during the pandemic. Shane Phelan writes that details of shocking cases of neglect are revealed today by the Child Care Law Reporting Project, and that inability to attend school for lengthy periods is likely to have increased the isolation of vulnerable children and heightened the risk of serious neglect going unnoticed. The story is carried across the broadsheets, and there is detail of some of the cases, including one girl who was admitted to a hospital's intensive care unit with a severe infection due to scabies, and the most serious case of head lice ever seen by a paediatric consultant who gave evidence. Various angles on the rollout of COVID-19 vaccinations provide stories on several front pages this morning, with the Irish Examiner's lead that the government has been accused of flying kites and causing confusion over the hoped-for early delivery of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Elaine O'Loughlin writes that the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, has yet to get confirmation from the manufacturer on whether this is actually possible. She adds that Social Democrats co-leader Roisin Shortall yesterday hit out at the minister for misleading the public, saying that Stephen Donnelly needs to stop flying false kites. And the distribution of vaccines is front page news for the Irish Times and the Irish Independent, with both papers carrying the story that the master of the Coombe Hospital, Professor Michael O'Connell, has apologised after it emerged that 16 family members of staff at the hospital were vaccinated with leftover doses on the 8th of January. Responding to questions, Dr. O'Connell said the decision to vaccinate family members of staff at the hospital was made to ensure no vaccine was wasted, and that he personally made every effort to prioritise and identify additional frontline workers and followed all measures available at the time. Elsewhere in the Irish Times, reports on the weekend mass vaccination of GPs in Dublin, Portlaoise and Galway, with Dr. Nuala O'Connor, who is COVID lead with the ICGP, describing how they were authorised to try and get an 11th dose out of the 10-dose Moderna vaccine vial. No single vaccine dose is going to be missed, she said. We will be pulling people in at short notice. Hero mum fights off three knife men is the lead headline for the Irish Sun, above the story of 30-year-old Emma Hanrahan of Balbriggan, who was targeted on Friday while she was out for a walk. And that story is covered in the Irish Independent also. Finally, news of a major bequest to the UCC School of Music is carried on the front page of the Irish Examiner. The university's music department has been left €2 million by the late Sidney V. Regan, a British music lover and master builder who came to Cork in the 1960s. With his wife Hilda. It's the single largest gift to the music department in its 113-year history, according to the head of the school, Geoffrey Wheater, who said this act of unmatched generosity will enrich the lives of current and future students immeasurably.
France is considering asking lorry drivers to prove that they are COVID-19 free before they cross its border. The transport minister here, Eamon Ryan, told This Week that the French authorities may agree to hauliers having an antigen test rather than a PCR one. Direct routes from Ireland to France have increased since Brexit as they avoid delays on the UK land bridge. Well, we are joined now by Eugene Drennan, who is president of the Irish Road Hauliers Association. Eugene, what more do you know about this?
Well, it looks like if it is moving towards the acceptance of the antigen test, and it also looks like as if the French will request it. But outside of that, we asked for this and requested it a month ago in mid-December because we should have it to protect our ferries. And whatever the French are looking for, okay, we may have to adhere to, but we should be moving to protect ourselves. And I think that the French have quite a criteria on this antigen test, but one of the ones to look for is called a REALI test, which is proving and has undergone trials to be nearly 98% accurate. Mm-hmm. So having said that, it is available in this country, it can be done, and we should do it, irrespective of the French. Think about okay. Ireland yeah. and protect our drivers and our ferries.
How would it work, Eugene? How would it work? Would the drivers take it as they're preparing to cross?
Well, it's done similar to the PCR test in that it is a nose swab. Prepare at the ports, you know. At least the minister has acknowledged that we have pressure on our ports and the traffic structure and may not be able to get into the ports. But it should be done at the ports to save time. Time is crucial for drivers because of the limited driving time. And it must be done by a company that is competent in giving the test and can transfer the driver's driving card license or his passport, if it is a card, onto transfer it onto the test result to authenticate the test. And it can be taken, say, and within 15, 20, 30 minutes, take the test, take the driver's telephone number. He would get the result then to his phone. He waits to get the result, and if he's showing signs of positive, it is good for, say, definitely 3 days and perhaps up to 5 days ahead of somebody showing symptom. If anything is going on in the blood or with the protein, if they don't have the protein, that they may be getting COVID. And I can tell them, and if we have a case brewing, we can rescue the driver, take him home while he's ill, and transfer a new driver in. Plus, keep the ferries. The big thing here for us is to keep the ferries safe, keep the driver travelling on the ferries safe, and keep him with the knowledge that there are other people travelling on the ferries now, because there's virtually no passengers. Yeah. So that they are in pretty safe environments, as safe as it can be at this time.
And you're very keen to stress that this morning, because this would be detrimental to hauliers' business if there was an outbreak.
Absolutely. Yes, we have a big transfer of freight going on the direct ferries now. We have many new ferries going to France direct out of Rosslare and Dublin. We have absolute chaos in Dublin Port. It's not up to speed. They're not up to getting the lines of freight in and out of Ireland with the systems they're using there. Lots of trouble there.
So is that because of Brexit and customs?
Because of Brexit
and
because of course, customs and the type of the computers they're using and the systems they're using aren't really big enough for when the big flow comes on. We're working at reduced numbers now. But when the pressure comes on of full flow again, I don't think it's up to scratch. So we absolutely must keep the continental lines open. And now that we have the ferries running, that we have the opportunity to go direct, if anything happens, one ferry, we're in a reasonable amount of trouble. But should two ferries go down with COVID outbreaks, we are back in serious problems. We're still an island. It won't change.
Yeah, that is true. Who would pay for the test? Presumably these would be privately paid for tests, Eugene.
Well, I suppose it might be a mixture of where the state would provide the facility there, would have to underwrite having the facility there because it has to be there for 24/7 virtually, or definitely 16 hours of the 7 days, and then a nominal fee to the driver or to the company who is getting the test, a mixture of charging. Would be the way. We have companies in Ireland who have these tests ready available. I know of one, I'm in Innes, I know of one company here who has tried 3 or 4 of the antigen tests during the summer and has come up with one that is positive. Similar to a pregnancy test, like it's a quick taking of the sample from the nose swipe and then a rapid, or as fast as you can, result. And as I say, it wins up to maybe 95 or 98% proved that to be accurate, and it would keep us as safe as we can be in these times.
Okay. Well, look, thank you very much for talking to us this morning, Eugene
thank
Drennan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eugene Drennan, President of the Irish Road Hauliers Association. It's 7:17.
The CEO of the privately owned Beacon Hospital has hit back at the tongue-lashing the hospital received from the HSE boss Paul Reid at the weekend as the health system copes with the biggest crisis in the state's history and hospitals around the country enter surge capacity. He said it was incomprehensible and beyond frustrating that the Beacon had not signed up to the new health agreement with the private hospitals. It's the only private hospital not to sign up to the deal, which sees the private system agreeing to provide up to 30% of their capacity. Michael Cullen is CEO of the Beacon Hospital. He joins me now. And Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
Alone you are standing among the private hospitals in not signing up to this deal at a time when Paul Reid and others have said the health system is facing its greatest ever crisis. Why would you take this position?
Mary, we took this position because of our experience in the previous surge in April, May and June of last year, when having signed the HSE agreement, we were left with the hospital being 70% empty for the duration of that agreement, when our hospital immediately before it was operating at 90%+ capacity and immediately afterwards was operating at 90%+ capacity. We were disappointed with Paul Reid's comments at the weekend because I don't think they accurately or adequately reflected the fact that the hospital we are currently and have been for the last number of months providing significant capacity to the public system by way of inpatient surgeries, day case surgeries, diagnostics and intensive care. And that's why we felt we had to, in fairness to our own staff, our own doctors, who have been working very, very hard on these patients, we felt we had to respond and put the record straight.
And aside, you would not sign up. Just 2 points on that. Back in March, I suppose, it was a very different time, and the medical profession know much more now than they did then about treating COVID, and also the health system about the capacity that's needed. And on the question of you providing all of the other systems to the public system, you were paid for offering up your capacity in March, and you are paid when you when your facilities are used to treat public patients now.
Yeah, we were, Mary, but you know, this was never about money. This was the fact that we had a facility which is geared up to operate at full capacity, and we were only able to treat 30% of the patients who would normally be treated in Beacon. A huge number of patients did not get treated who should have been treated during that time.
So is now, this all about your disillusionment with the first deal?
This was about disillusionment and our need to be able to have operational control and be able to treat our own patients, or indeed the patients of the public system.
What do you mean by operational control?
Never about being unable to treat public patients or private patients. This was to be able to control our own activity.
The nub of it here for you, you're saying, is operational control.
Control. And to that end, discussions have been ongoing with the HSE, and I'm delighted to say that late last night, the HSE sent us a revised agreement, which they say addresses the concerns raised by ourselves over the past 2 weeks. On January the 5th, we received an 85-page document asking us to sign it. We felt unable to sign it. The HSE have come back late last night. This new agreement or redraft, they say, addresses the concerns raised
by
ourselves.
What do you say?
Well, we've been looking at it all night. I think it goes a long way towards doing that. We have a number of clarifications, and we are meeting the HSE later today.
Okay, so does this mean you will sign up? It does mean you will sign up then.
Well, I can't say that until we get answers to our clarifications. It is our desire to sign up, Mary, because we know we're treating those patients. We are doing more than any other hospital in the country in dealing with over 30% of our capacity in treating public patients. Under the National Treatment Purchase Fund and various agreements with individual public hospitals.
And Michael, do you have spare capacity in the hospital at the moment? Do you have capacity in your ICU?
We have. Our ICU is generally at full capacity most of the week. This evening, it'll be at full capacity. Right this morning, we're at about 50%, but there's a lot of very significant public patient surgeries going on today, and those patients will end up in our ICU. So we will be at full capacity this evening.
And what's your bed capacity in the hospital generally?
We have 180 inpatient beds. We're at 85% capacity this morning. We will be at approximately 95% capacity this evening.
Okay, and can we expect an announcement one way or the other later on today?
It is our great hope, given the fact that we are already providing more public capacity than the agreement asks for. I think it would be really disappointing if we weren't able to reach an agreement. I'm delighted that this agreement seems to address our concerns. And once we're able to control our own hospital, we're more than happy to sign the HSE agreement. We believe we've been wearing the green jersey and we're happy to sign the agreement.
Okay. Michael Cullen of the Beacon Hospital.
Well, healthcare and frontline workers are part of a group of around 4,000 people who will get their Irish citizenship from today. Mary Regan of our political staff can tell us more. Mary, this is something that has been called for. These healthcare workers and frontline staff, but they were due to get their citizenship around now. It's probably delayed anyway, is it?
Yeah, well, there has been a push on from healthcare workers from outside of EU countries to have their applications fast-tracked in recognition of their work during the pandemic. There is a campaign group called Train Us for Ireland, representing around 200 migrant healthcare workers. They wrote to the Taoiseach de Tánaiste, the President Michael D. Higgins, and the Minister for Justice last month, saying really that for those who had met all the criteria, you know, which was that they would be resident in Ireland for 5 years, paying taxes and have good character, for those who have met that criteria and are on waiting lists, you know, the system should be fast-tracked. Now, the position of the Department of Justice all along has been that there are no particular provisions and no intention to apply provisions to different applications, applicants based on their work. You know that all applicants would be processed in line with the legislation. That has been the position. But Minister Helen McEntee said today that a significant number of healthcare and frontline workers will now benefit from the new arrangements that are in place from today. And she said they've made an extraordinary contribution during the pandemic and they will benefit from the new application process, which comes into effect from today.
Okay. So this citizenship, the people who will get their citizenship from today, how is that working in these COVID times?
Yes, well, the latest figures show that there are around 23,200 applicants currently being processed. And one of the reasons for waiting times increasing over 2020 has been that citizenship ceremonies were put on hold. The last one took place last March. Because of the pandemic, they couldn't hold them. So the new system being put in place today will allow people to sign a statutory declaration in the presence of a witness, and that will replace the citizenship ceremony in making them become Irish citizens. So that is the final stage, if you like. Now, the minister says this will benefit around 4,000 applicants who are in the, you know, the final stages of their application for citizenship, but who haven't been able to get over that final line because the ceremonies have not been taking place.
And do we know much more about the people who will be getting their citizenship from today, where they're from, Mary?
We don't particularly know, and the only group she does mention is the frontline workers, and I suppose that would be because, you know, many of them might have been waiting for longer than 2 years. However, we do know that in 2020 in particular, the highest number of new applicants came from the UK, and that, you know, that is different from previous years when they would have been from other countries.
Okay. Mary, thank you so much indeed. Mary Regan there of our political staff on the news that around 4,000 people will get their Irish citizenship from today, including a significant percentage of healthcare and frontline workers.
First check on the business headlines now with Brian Finn.
Mary, thank you. Good morning. Estate agents say they're struggling to meet demand for property, especially from first-time buyers. A survey of 800 agents carried out by the Society of Chartered Surveyors found that over two-thirds predicted property price increases of on average 4% in the year ahead, driven mainly by lack of supply. Just under a quarter are expecting prices to remain the same, with just 8% expecting price reductions. Business startup activity hit a four-year low in 2020. The credit risk firm CRIF Vision Net recorded just below 22,000 new company registrations. That was down 4% on 2019. However, the overall insolvency rate was down almost 11% in the year, with 570 firms going out of business. The reduction was partly accounted for by the closure of the courts during the pandemic, but also the provision of state supports to businesses. The vast majority of almost 400 CEOs surveyed by IBEX see a global economic downturn as their biggest challenge in the year ahead. This was followed by the challenge of achieving profitability and the fallout from Brexit. On the currency markets, the euro is trading at $1.21 and 89 pence sterling.
It is time for sport. Darren Frehill, good morning to you.
Good morning to you as well, Mary. And we'll start with the soccer from yesterday. Manchester United, top of the Premier League. But it was a scoreless draw away to Liverpool. Liverpool dominating the early possession, but it was United who probably had the better chances in the second half. It was one of those games, I think we're all really looking forward to it, but just didn't live up to the pre-match hype. Do these games ever, I wonder? The Liverpool manager, Jurgen Klopp, though, was pretty upbeat afterwards.
A lot of good stuff. Obviously, what we miss is a goal. If we win this game 1-0, then I think it's completely fine because of the possession we had, the football we played, a lot of things. You cannot deny Man United for 90 minutes. We never could. I think the boys played a really good game tonight, my boys. And against a good side, good organized side, but first half we played exceptionally well. We kept them under pressure. The counter press was great. The passing was good. Positioning was good. We didn't score. So we know that's the most important thing in football. So we don't want to miss that, but we missed it. They had two big chances, I have to say, with Ali to make two really big saves. So we would have better used the chance in the first half. That would have helped the result, especially. But the performance was good.
Now, Manchester City are second in the standings, closing the gap at the top to just 2 points with a 4-0 win against Wolves. And it really is a packed leaderboard. United on top on 37 points, City on 35. They have a game in hand. Leicester level with them on points. They're in third place. Liverpool fourth on 34. And Spurs, who beat Sheffield United 3-1, are fifth. So there's just 4 points separating the top five. I think it's going to be a really exciting run-in. We'll be going into this in a bit more detail in the next hour here on Morning Ireland. Good news this morning for the Irish cricket team, because their one-day international against UAE got the go-ahead. 4 previous matches had to be postponed because of COVID-19 concerns. It wasn't a good start, though. Started just after 5:30 a.m. this morning, Irish time. The hosts won the toss. They opted to bowl first, and Ireland lost 3 early wickets. They have settled, but are 88 for 4 after 27 overs. The former Cork footballer, Breed Stack, is making a full recovery after what looked like a serious injury playing for Greater Western Sydney Giants down under in the international rules yesterday. She collided with an opponent during a practice match, taken to hospital with spinal support, but the reports we're hearing are she will be fine. Envoy Allen won an 11th straight race as he won the Killiney Novices Chase at Punchestown, the favourite ridden by Jack Kennedy. The Gordon Elliott trained horse will be looking for a third win at Cheltenham in March.
Look, he did what he had to do. It was unfortunate the horse fell, it would have made a good race over, but listen, our job done now.
What was the reason for coming here and say bypassing the Dublin Racing Festival on your route to Cheltenham?
Look, at last year I kind of done the same, went from Nace to Cheltenham. To be honest, a little bit nervous at the ground in Epperson. You know, if you got a dry week or 10 days up to it, the chase course, for me, you know, just for these big horses, is riding plenty quick. Listen, we'd enjoy today and all roads lead to Cheltenham.
Yeah, we won't feel to that either. More racing at Punchestown today. The first race goes to post at 1:05. Ireland ended their 5-game series with the friendly internationals with Spain, the Irish women's hockey team drawing 4-4 with the Spanish. And finally, great story in the Masters snooker. 20-year-old Yang Bing Tao beat John Higgins, making his debut at the tournament. That's your sport for now. Back just after the news at 8:30. Back to you, Audrey.
Now, last month, the Minister for Housing, Dara O'Brien, told Morning Ireland that rough sleepers looking for a bed in emergency accommodation in Dublin would not be turned away because they originally came from outside of the capital. This is what the Minister said to Gavin Jennings back in December.
I want to say first, and it's really important that listeners know this, that there is bed capacity. No one is being turned away from emergency accommodation.
And a local connection is not necessary, is that right?
I've instructed my own team there that it is not necessary. If people need to seek emergency accommodation, they're not being turned away.
But a new documentary from RTE Investigates, which examines rough sleeping in Dublin, found that despite the minister's statement last month, people have been refused beds in emergency accommodation because they did not have a local connection or they were registered as homeless in another county. We're joined this morning by Kieran Dineen from RTE Investigates. Kieran, what's the background to your programme?
For the past 3 months, myself, producer Janet Traynor and cameraman Matt Nocton have documented life on the street for some of the homeless community who either sleep rough or who use emergency hostel accommodation to get a bed at night. One thing you learn very quickly is rough sleeping is a complex subject. That said, one issue rough sleepers told us about from the start of the project was the fact some of them could not get access to an emergency bed in Dublin. Then in December, Minister Dara O'Brien makes that statement, so we decided to test the minister's statement to see if it was being followed through on the ground. Within 4 days, we found 2 people who were refused beds, despite what had been said. One of them was Joe Nolan, who's in his 50s and originally from Carlow. Joe's living rough in Dublin. We filmed him as he called a free phone number operated by the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive, and this is what happened.
My name is Joe Nolan. I'm ringing for a bed for the night.
Well,
I can't book you anywhere. Like.
I'm pushing on nearly 60, I'm 59, yeah?
Hang on a minute now, excuse me. I'm fairness.
Oh, that's the problem.
I don't need the story because, you know, you can ring, you have a system.
You don't need a story.
Ring up and start to, yeah. You have registered in Carlo, so you should interact. Now you're in Dublin, we can't do anything, of course.
And it turns out, Kieran, there were beds free on that night. Is that right?
Figures provided by the DRHE show there were 75 empty beds on the night Joe Nolan made that call. A second homeless man, who didn't wish to be identified, also made a similar call to the DRHE free phone number the night previous to Joe. He was told he would not get a bed because he was registered in a different county. Both these men ended up bedding down in different car parks for the night. In an interview for the documentary, Minister Dara O'Brien apologised to both men and said it should not have happened. He also said there is capacity in Dublin and he wants to see that used. When we asked the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive if it was at odds with the Minister's statement, the DRHE said they look at everybody on a case-by-case basis and use their maximum discretion. They also pointed out they are not responsible for providing homeless accommodation for everybody in the country.
Kieran, RT Investigates also carried out a survey of rough sleepers as part of the documentary. Will you take us through some of the findings?
We surveyed 80 rough sleepers and hostel users in association with Amoric Research. It was a very detailed questionnaire and ranged from reasons for becoming homeless to their opinions on emergency hostel accommodation to the impact on their mental health. And some of the findings are quite stark. For example, the survey shows how drugs impact on many rough sleepers. A lot of the time, the public perception is people end up on the street because of drugs. While that's true in some cases of those we surveyed, 48% said they were not addicted to any substances prior to being homeless. However, after becoming homeless, one in every two of those who ended up on the street fell into addiction, many of them becoming seriously addicted to serious drugs like heroin, cocaine and crack cocaine. Mike Allen of Focus Ireland spoke to us about this very issue.
It's shocking, but very often we look at people who are homeless and we see the drug addiction they have and we think that that's the cause of their homelessness. Well, in actual fact, many of the problems that people who are homeless have are consequences of their homelessness. The sheer misery, the sheer mental pressure of living in circumstances where you have no home and the security that should go with a home.
Okay. That's Mike Allen there of Focus Ireland. Quite a stark statistic. One in every two of those who end up in the street fall into addiction after they become homeless. Kieran, thank you so much. Kieran Dineen there of RTE Investigates and his investigation Stuck in the Rough. It will be on your television screens tonight. RTE One Television at 9:35. It's 7:44 now.
And we're almost 1 week on from publication of the Mother and Baby Homes report, and the fallout is continuing. The Catholic Primate of All Ireland, Archbishop Eamon Martin, told RT Radio's This Week programme that religious orders may be willing to discuss the possibility of providing compensation to survivors. But despite accepting that some of the conditions in these institutions were harrowing, he has been criticised for his comment, saying religious orders should not be scapegoated for what happened.
I think that that's something that the minister and whatever scheme is put in place for redress will be able to establish. But could I just say one thing? I would be disappointed if, you know, we were having read the commission's report to scapegoat, I think, the religious congregations. You know, I think they were commissioned by the state and by local authorities and county councils. They were expected to intervene when the rest of society had basically banished these mothers and their unborn children and infants. And they too were Irish women who answered a call to serve, and they found themselves kind of on the front line of this.
That was Archbishop Eamon Martin. Susan Lohan is co-founder of the Adoption Rights Alliance and a member of the Collaborative Forum on Mother and Baby Homes. And Susan, you're welcome to Morning Ireland.
Good morning, Mary.
The Archbishop, he addressed many issues during the course of his This Week interview yesterday. He talked about the lack of information around the burial sites and he appealed for information. He addressed the issue of reparations. But it is this comment that has this scapegoating comment, it's particularly upset you and other survivors.
Well, I generally found his apology, I felt it was a masterclass on obfuscation, and he attempted on so many occasions to diminish the role of the Catholic Church. He kept referring to religious orders, made no reference to the fact that it was the Catholic Church under his predecessors who dictated how society responded to unmarried mothers and their children. And the fact that they tendered for this business, it was a business. They received government funding to run these places behind the high walls. They made profit from the unpaid labour of the women, from the piecework that the women did in those institutions, and the fact that the women did all of their own laundry, cooked all of their own meals, did all of the cleaning. But of course, the bottom line is that the church profited from the trafficking of children externally to the US and, of course, internally to what they regarded as good Catholic families. And for that, they received so many donations. And that's been completely disregarded by Eamon Martin.
But can he ever say enough to satisfy...
Yes,
to satisfy you and other survivors? He talked about the shame. He talked about how women were shamed and stigmatized and his sadness that this happened.
Right.
It didn't happen on his watch.
No, it didn't, but it happened as a result, a direct result of the attitudes ingrained in Irish society by the organization of which he is both the spiritual and the managerial head. And I felt that his comments about sadness, he swept up all of Ireland in that comment. Let the people of Ireland speak for themselves. Let Eamon Martin speak for the Catholic Church and all of his predecessors. I would actually draw an analogy between what his predecessors did to what Trump did last week. So his predecessors, they belted the pulpit every weekend at Sunday Mass, told people how to treat these unmarried mothers and their children. So having radicalized them, essentially, he now wants to put this distance between his organization and what society did. And that's no different to what happened in the Capitol in Washington last week.
For those that would say you are being unfair to Archbishop Martin and to the church, and to those who would say that society did play a part, these homes were subject to inspection by the state. It was families who in many cases placed young girls in these institutions. To those who would say that the Archbishop is right in how he set out the narrative of that time, what would you say? And he's not the only one who talked about societal responsibility.
But you see, that's the get-out-of-jail card that they've been given by the Commission. It's astonishing that in his statement yesterday, he referred to, you know, community, society, the Catholic religious orders, and the unmarried fathers, about them paying reparations. Now, that is such nonsense, as if the unmarried fathers were some sort of collective who amassed great wealth in the
duration
of these homes.
The report also refer to fathers and families?
Well, again, I think it's becoming increasingly evident that survivors are probably going to ask for the findings of the commission either to be reviewed or set aside. And I welcome Regina Doherty's comments last night. It's about time that the women from Fine Gael came forward, and she has been talking about having the commission's findings reviewed.
Yes, that's Senator Regina Doherty. She called it a callous report on RT Radio yesterday and called, as you say, for the independent review. What form could an independent review take, do you think, Susan?
Well, I think we certainly have allies in the UN who'd be very, very willing to take part in such a review. I think it should include international figures, because so often those of us in Ireland, we've become desensitized to the various church-state scandals that have engulfed us over the last two decades. So the likes of Felice Gare, who responded so compassionately to Maeve O'Rourke's testimony about the conditions for women in the Magdalen laundries, she would be one very excellent candidate who could potentially chair such a group.
And Susan, just to move on to the vaccine trials, which are also highlighted in a comprehensive chapter in the report, do you believe that those companies that were involved, that they should be stepping up and that they should be asked in some way to contribute to some form of redress?
Absolutely, because they have admitted that they breached the guidelines regarding vaccine trials that were in place even at that time. And it's astonished all of us who've had a chance to read some of the report that the Commission could make a bold statement about nobody having been harmed by these 4 in 1 in 5 in 1 vaccines.
There has no been evidence of injury.
No longitudinal study, and the Commission didn't even inquire from the vaccine participants what state their health was in 2021. So that, for certain, that conclusion should be set aside.
For now, Susan, thank you very much for joining us. Susan Lohan there, co-founder of the Adoption Rights Alliance. It's 7:51.
We're joined this morning by the CEO of the business group IBEC, Danny McCoy. And you've been talking to CEOs of companies of all sizes about their outlook for the year ahead, Danny. No prizes for guessing what the main issues are, but it's the global picture, it appears, that's concerning them most.
It is, yeah. Good morning. It was a survey of over 380 business leaders right across the various sectors, some experiencing quite a good year in 2020, others the disaster of COVID. But when they are environment scanning, I think it's interesting that we see that the investment in trying to take what are the trends here, the move to remote working, greater digitalization, but also an emphasis on employee well-being is really coming out in the survey.
Brexit was high on the agenda as well. We're a few weeks into the new trade regime and there are delays on both sides at ports. We've probably all encountered an empty supermarket shelf at this stage. Is this problem going to get worse before it gets better?
It may do, but I do think it is by the nature of trade agreements and particularly the very little time on specifics of the details. You know, this was really on Christmas Eve, quite a vast majority knew that the administrative rules were going to change. The precise details, I think, have caught people a little bit by surprise. But it will work through, and hopefully with COVID as well, we'll see that work through. And the emphasis then, as the survey is saying, will come on to the retention and upskilling of people and employee well-being. And I think they will be some of the main drivers. The other issue, I think, which is not a current priority, given everything else is going on, is that trend to a low carbon transition. I think that's taken somewhat of a back seat because of the other priorities, but I would expect that the environmental, social and governance issues, so-called ESG factors, will be a dominant priority for 2022 onwards.
And looking to life post-pandemic, Danny, and you mentioned remote working, and there are plans afoot from the government to give employees the right to request remote working. Is that a welcome development from your point of view?
In the vast majority of businesses that can facilitate that, it is, because, again, it's on that retention of talent and also about employee well-being. But there has to be an equal right here for employers whose the nature of their business requires people to be at a location. And I think that default position of where work is needs to move from the default position to where we are today, which is a lot of people staying at home, rightly, given the COVID issues we have right now. So I think there will be a balancing of the rights of the employee and the rights of employers. And I think that's something we'll work with the government on during this consultation and implementation phase.
And the COVID pandemic is dictating pretty much everything in, or a lot in business at the moment. The indications are that parts of the economy might be looking at a fairly lengthy closure, possibly up until Easter. Is that sustainable, do you think?
Look, the government have the resources, and I think that has to be prioritised for the sectors that now have been suppressed, in some cases, for nearly a year. It's important that we get this right now, that we actually suppress the virus to the point where the vaccines can help. What we need is to make sure that this lockdown actually is effective. I think it's in everybody's interest. I know we've learned a lot from 2020. I think we've got an opportunity now working together, everybody staying at home that can, and also that we actually put the resources to those who are suppressed and their livelihoods have been threatened.
And is the vaccine rollout happening fast enough, do you think?
Well, look, the only thing that we can do, and this is anybody in production, is that we actually ensure that the supply is administered efficiently. And so at the moment, it's a supply constraint, and that appears to be going rather well, actually. Let's hope we can get future supply faster and then that we actually get everybody vaccinated. That will help us. But, you know, we're actually a victim of the supply train coming towards us, and if we can ensure that our system is able to make sure that all the supply we have at any moment of time is actually efficiently put out there, then I think it is on track.
Danny McCoy, CEO of IBEC, thank you very much. More business news at 8:30. Audrey.
So first of all, just a quick look ahead for the week that's coming up. Patchy light rain today, then heavy rain tonight and tomorrow, with the rain, which may turn wintry in the east on Wednesday, clearing Wednesday night, and then it turns colder with wintry showers for Thursday, Friday and for the weekend. Back to the present then, becoming overcast and misty today with patchy light rain and drizzle in the southwest during the morning, pushing northeastwards through the afternoon, and then a band of heavier and more persistent rain will move into the southwest this evening. Cool in Ulster today, but milder elsewhere as the cloud and rain arrives, with highs of only 5 degrees in the north today to 9 or 10 degrees in the south by this evening. So rain then in all areas overnight tonight, heaviest and most persistent over the northern half of the country and in the west. Local flooding is possible in these areas. Lows tonight of around 3 to 8 degrees, coolest in the north, in strengthening southwesterly winds, which will become strong on coasts. So tomorrow is wet, breezy, a murky day overall, with heavy falls of rain across the northern half of the country especially. The rain will be less persistent elsewhere, but there will also be some heavy outbreaks of rain in all areas. So it's cool again tomorrow in the north especially, with highs of only 4 degrees, milder elsewhere with highs of around 9 or 10. And because of the heavy rain tonight and tomorrow, we have a yellow rainfall warning in place for much of the northern half of the country, and that starts at 9 p.m. tonight and it runs until 9 p.m. tomorrow night. Northerly winds then become established Wednesday, and this heralds a change to colder weather. However, we will still have rain in the south and east on Wednesday, which will be heavy at times, and this will turn wintry on Wednesday through the afternoon and evening as the cold air arrives. Snow then is likely over higher ground in Leinster later on Wednesday. Then this weather, which is a bit colder, with wintry showers, will stay with us up to and including the weekend. And that's your forecast. Have a very good day.
The Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, has appealed to employers to facilitate remote working for employees. Dr. Houlihan described the situation in the country's hospitals as stark and said people should not go into work this week if they can work from home. Sinead Crowley reports.
Yesterday, 13 additional deaths were reported from COVID-19 and 2,944 new infections. That number is a slight decrease on previous days. However, the pressure on the country's hospital system is continuing. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Tony Houlihan described the current situation in hospitals as stark and urged people to stay at home, asking workers to work from home if possible and employers to facilitate that. Meanwhile, the National Immunisation Advisory Committee has considered the deaths of 23 frail elderly people in Norway following the administration of a COVID-19 vaccine. The NIAC noted that this did not imply the vaccine caused the deaths. It said vaccination offers the best opportunity to protect people in residential care and said vaccination rollout here should continue as planned. But it also said that assessment of risk should be carried out in certain patients to take account of the timescale of the response to the vaccine, and that it's not appropriate to vaccinate people if their expected duration of life is less than the length it takes for the vaccine to take effect.
A new report has found that COVID-19 is having a severe and disproportionate impact on vulnerable children. The Child Care Law Reporting Project has found instances of severe neglect, as well as addiction and domestic violence. Our legal affairs correspondent, Orla O'Donnell.
The Child Care Law Reporting Project publishes regular reports from the courts where orders are made relating to children in care. It collects and analyses the data and publishes it on an anonymous basis. The project's director, Dr. Carol Coulter, said the COVID-19 pandemic had been difficult for all children, but had a disproportionate impact on the most vulnerable. Some children in care have been deprived of meaningful access visits with their parents, and assessments essential to their future care have been reduced or delayed. Parents with addiction or mental health issues are also having difficulties accessing therapy that might help them overcome their problems and be reunited with their children. Dr. Coulter also raised instances of severe neglect, such as children in two separate cases who were hospitalised with infections caused by head lice infestations. This raised an issue, she said, about whether the prolonged closure of schools meant teachers had been cut off from protecting vulnerable children and the neglect had gone unnoticed for too long. She suggested the government should consider early vaccination for child protection workers and foster carers to try to reduce the impact as much as possible.
The CEO of the Beacon Hospital in Dublin has said he will meet officials from the HSE later today to discuss a revised agreement aimed at having the hospital provide additional capacity for the health system as it deals with COVID-19. The Beacon is the only private hospital not to sign up to a deal to provide up to 30% of their capacity. Speaking on this programme, Michael Cullen said the revised document addresses concerns raised.
I think it would be really disappointing if we weren't able to reach an agreement. I'm delighted that this agreement seems to address our concerns. And once we're able to control our own hospital, we're more than happy to sign the HSE agreement.
Some 4,000 people who have not been able to become Irish citizens because of COVID-19 restrictions will be able to do so under a temporary system that comes into effect from today. A statutory declaration signed in the presence of an official witness will replace citizenship ceremonies. Mary Regan reports.
The last citizenship ceremonies held in early March saw 5,000 people from 135 countries welcomed as Irish citizens. But as a result of COVID restrictions, no in-person ceremonies have been held since, contributing to a backlog of 24,000 applications. Some 4,000 of those are in the final stages and would have received a certificate of naturalisation if the ceremonies had proceeded. But from today, a signed and witnessed statutory declaration will replace the ceremonies to secure Irish citizenship. The Justice Minister, Helen McEntee, said this is a temporary arrangement which she hopes will bring certainty to people whose applications have effectively been put on hold because of the pandemic.
Gardaí have said that despite widespread compliance with the 5 kilometre travel restrictions across the country, over 170 fixed charge notices were issued to motorists in County Wicklow at the weekend. More than 200 cars were turned around and cautions issued to drivers on Saturday alone. Elsewhere, one Garda checkpoint in County Longford issued 30 fixed charge notices yesterday with more than 70 cars turned around. The US and several European governments have demanded the release of Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny, who was arrested yesterday on his return to Moscow. The activist was returning from Germany, 5 months after he was almost killed in a nerve agent attack he blamed on Russian authorities. President Vladimir Putin's government denies poisoning Mr. Navalny. Now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Centra. Staying close to home is how we all live every day right now. So know that at Centra, we have everything you need.
Some bright spells in the north and east this morning, but becoming overcast and misty with scattered outbreaks of light rain and drizzle in the southwest, moving northeastwards. A band of more persistent rain will move into the southwest later. Highest temperatures 5 to 10 degrees, coolest in the north.
COVID child neglect fears is the stark headline on the front of this morning's Irish Independent, above detail that vulnerable children are at increased risk while schools are closed during the pandemic. Shane Phelan writes that details of shocking cases of neglect are revealed today by the Child Care Law Reporting Project, and that inability to attend school for lengthy periods is likely to have increased the isolation of vulnerable children and heightened the risk of serious neglect going unnoticed. The story is carried across the broadsheets, and there is detail of some of the cases, including one girl who was admitted to a hospital's intensive care unit with a severe infection due to scabies, and the most serious case of head lice ever seen by a paediatric consultant who gave evidence. Various angles on the rollout of COVID-19 vaccinations provide stories on several front pages this morning, with the Irish Examiner's lead that the government has been accused of flying kites and causing confusion over the hoped-for early delivery of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Elaine O'Loughlin writes that the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, has yet to get confirmation from the manufacturer on whether this is actually possible. She adds that Social Democrats co-leader Roisin Shortall yesterday hit out at the minister for misleading the public, saying that Stephen Donnelly needs to stop flying false kites. And the distribution of vaccines is front page news for the Irish Times and the Irish Independent, with both papers carrying the story that the master of the Coombe Hospital, Professor Michael O'Connell, has apologised after it emerged that 16 family members of staff at the hospital were vaccinated with leftover doses on the 8th of January. Responding to questions, Dr. O'Connell said the decision to vaccinate family members of staff at the hospital was made to ensure no vaccine was wasted, and that he personally made every effort to prioritise and identify additional frontline workers and followed all measures available at the time. Elsewhere in the Irish Times, reports on the weekend mass vaccination of GPs in Dublin, Port Leisha and Galway, with Dr. Nuala O'Connor, who is COVID lead with the ICGP, describing how they were authorised to try and get an 11th dose out of the 10-dose Moderna vaccine vial. No single vaccine dose is going to be missed, she said. We will be pulling people in at short notice. Calls for review as survivors ignored is the headline on page 2 of the Examiner, above the story that the leader of the Shannon, Regina Doherty, has said that the final report of the Mother and Baby Home Commission cannot be accepted by the government and must be independently reviewed. She told the Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 yesterday that the report was cold and callous, and criticised the commission for ignoring the testimony of women who gave birth in the mother and baby homes and their children. The Irish News leads on the story that Gavin Robinson, the DUP MP, tipped by many as the future leader of the party, believes that unionism should prepare for a border poll. Finally, the Irish Independent has detail of the frosty feedback sent to Met Aaron from members of the public venting their frustration at the impact of forecasts on their daily lives. On June 30th of last year, one correspondent complained that in a summer already impacted by COVID-19, the forecaster had been ruining my days by giving me false forecasts. I just want to live my youth, they added. While this message to Met Aaron simply said, spent afternoon in hot Crosshaven carrying a raincoat, based on iPhone forecast. It's 1800 hours and no sign of inclement weather.
There are almost 2,000 people with COVID-19 being treated in our hospitals. Around 10% of them are critically ill in intensive care. The very latest hospital figures are expected shortly. Yesterday evening it was announced that 13 people who had the virus died. Louth has the second highest 14-day incidence rate in the country after Monaghan. The number there is 2,237.7 per 100,000 population. We're joined this morning by Dr. Ian Cunahan, who is respiratory consultant. He's also clinical director for the Department of Medicine and COVID lead in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Drogheda. Dr. Cunahan, you're very welcome and thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland. Will you describe how your hospital is coping with the current COVID surge? Are you in surge capacity at this point?
Well, I think, as you'll imagine, we're very busy. I would say that we are in a degree of surge at the moment in terms of the number of wards that we've had to dedicate over to COVID. And we've had to increase the space in our emergency department that we allocate to our separate COVID stream from what we had been operating between July and up until the beginning of January. In our intensive care unit as well, we've moved to the second phase of our surge plan, which is where we move patients who don't have COVID out of the ICU, because so many of the patients in the intensive care unit do have COVID, as a way to protect them. So they're being managed in our coronary care unit on ventilators, the patients who don't have COVID.
Do you have much capacity then in ICU for more patients?
I think currently we have 10 patients in ICU, 8 of those have COVID. We have a capacity in our surge planning for up to 24 ventilated patients.
And as I said, second highest 14-day incidence rate in the country. That's being borne out, is it, in the hospital figures? Are you expecting those numbers to keep rising for the next week or so?
I think it has been borne out in the figures, certainly over the last week. Looking at this daily charts, I know that Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital topped the numbers of 24-hour admissions with COVID, I think, on 3 days last week nationally. So I'm hoping that it will have plateaued a little bit, and the rate and increase of numbers of patients admitted nationally seems to have slowed down over the last few days, since about Friday, is my sense.
And the sense from other hospital consultants and intensive care consultants is that the demographic of the patients that they're treating, it's a younger cohort than perhaps in the first wave, although there are significant numbers of older people in hospital as well. Is that the same in your hospital?
Yes, I think so. There's a large group of younger people that are admitted with COVID pneumonia. We have patients in their 20s, 30s and 40s in the hospital on oxygen. But in the certainly for the last week, we've also seen an increase in the number of patients presenting who are in their 70s and 80s who have a lot of comorbidities just through, I guess, being older and more likely to have other medical problems.
And how are you and your staff? Because it must be taking a huge toll on you all dealing with this 24/7.
Yeah, I think it's a huge stretch for all of our staff. If you know, we've been doing this now for almost a year at this point in terms of having a separate stream and the very stresses that come around from managing COVID patients, which are predominantly related to how sick they are, and to the infection prevention and control aspect of it, and trying to ensure patients who come in with symptoms that might be COVID but have a test that's not detected, being happy that they actually have another illness that's caused them to come into hospital, and that we're not missing a possible case of COVID that we send to a ward without the same infection control and prevention capabilities as our COVID ward. Yeah. So it's really very busy. I think we have about, on average last week, we had 20 patients on our wards who up until a year ago would likely have been in the intensive care unit or the high dependency unit beside our intensive care unit because of how ill they are and because of their high oxygen requirements.
And Dr. Cunahan, have many of your staff been vaccinated then at this point?
So we have about just over 2,300 staff, I think, between our two hospitals in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital and Louth County Hospital. And we've had 1,000 staff vaccinated over the past fortnight. So it's great that we've gotten some of our staff vaccinated, but obviously we'd like to have all of our staff vaccinated.
And do you know when the remaining 1,300 will have theirs administered?
I don't. I know that we our Department of Nursing have trained a vaccination team that have the capacity to give up to 1,700 vaccinations per week. So we could have certainly gotten everyone vaccinated very quickly. However, I know that we're not due to receive any vaccine this week. The vaccine team have volunteered themselves to go out to residential facilities and give the vaccine to nursing homes and other residential facilities this week. But we're obviously looking to get more vaccinations for our staff.
Yeah. So what do you think then when you read this morning that 16 leftover doses in the Coombe Hospital in Dublin were administered to relatives of staff there?
Well, to be honest, I have a lot of sympathy for them in the Coombe. I think there was a huge amount of pressure to start vaccinating people as quickly as possible when the vaccine landed in the country. And a lot of people saying, you know, how complicated could this be to give out the vaccinations? But really, it was only, we started vaccinating, I think, on the 29th of December. It was only, I think, on the 8th of January where we realised that we were able to give safely a sixth dose out of the vials of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. And so I think nationally, if we'd spent a little bit more time clarifying that at the beginning, we'd have saved a lot more vaccination doses than the few vaccination doses that were given to people who maybe weren't on a list in the Coombe Hospital. Yeah. I guess my, personally, from I would wonder why hospitals that have had demonstrably lower amounts of COVID over the last year were all vaccinated, such as the, you know, why the Coombe Hospital was picked to vaccinate all its staff ahead of hospitals like ourselves, Nina, Clonmel, other large acute hospitals around the country.
But given that you said that the doses that are coming in, that the staff are going to give them to people in long-term residential care rather than themselves first, does it, when you read this thing then about the Coombe, this information, does that undermine the vaccination programme in the minds of the public?
Well, I think that's the way it's being made sound, but I think the challenge is that when this vaccination is thawed and drawn up, it needs to be given to somebody in a very short period of time. So if you don't have somebody ready to take the vaccine, it's wasted. So certainly, you know, we're in a position where we haven't vaccinated all of our staff, but I know that the vaccinators found that they had extra doses and had to have someone they could find to get down to the vaccination area within 5 minutes and complete the paperwork in that time. So it is a challenge to ensure that you give all of the vaccination doses that are available, because it's not clear at the beginning of the day how many doses you'll have.
Understood. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Ian Cunahan, their respiratory consultant and clinical director for the Department of Medicine and COVID lead in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Drogheda. Well, let's talk more about that story reported in the Irish Times this morning, that the master of the Coombe Maternity Hospital in Dublin has apologised after it emerged that the hospital gave COVID-19 vaccines to 16 family members of staff. Our reporter Coleman O'Sullivan is following this story. Coleman, the Coombe has issued a statement. What are they saying?
They have, and that statement confirms the details as reported by the Irish Times, that 16 vaccine doses that had been made up were remaining at the end of the day, and the Coombe says to ensure those vaccines were not wasted, they were administered to family members of employees at the hospital. It says that of the 16 recipients, 9 were over 70 and the remaining 7 were varying ages. Now, the master of the Coombe, Michael O'Connell, said that the decision to use the vaccines that had already been made up was to ensure that not a single reconstituted vaccine was wasted. He said he personally made every effort to prioritise and identify additional frontline workers and followed all measures available to him at the time. However, he adds that in hindsight, as master, he deeply regrets that family members of employees were vaccinated, and for that he wholeheartedly apologises.
And the Minister for Health has also made a statement on this.
Yes, Stephen Donnelly has said that he was made aware on Sunday night of the situation which happened in the Coombe on Friday the 8th. And he says that trust in the vaccine programme is of critical importance and what happened should not have happened. He says that the vaccine allocation strategy clearly sets out a priority list for vaccination, and that's currently for frontline healthcare workers and residents and staff of long-term residential care facilities. It does not include family members of healthcare workers. He adds that he will be speaking with the chair of the Coombe Hospital Board for a full account of this issue.
Okay, Coleman O'Sullivan, many thanks. It's 8:23.
Now, a new report highlights what it's calling the severe and disproportionate toll this pandemic is taking on vulnerable children. The Child Care Law Reporting Project found these last months have seen reduced access by parents to children in care and restrictions on services for children and their parents. The project publishes regular reports from the courts where orders are made in relation to children in care situations. This report looks at cases in the second half of 2020, a period dominated, of course, by COVID-19. Dr. Carl Coulter is the director of the Child Care Law Reporting Project. Carl, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
And I think the points that you're making in relation to the toll it's taking, those points are best demonstrated by the stories you're telling. So we'll talk through some of them, if you don't mind. And if we could start with the story that you document of two children who had interim care orders made, and one of them ended up in intensive care. What happened?
Yes, this was quite a young child who, well, the paediatrician actually referred the child eventually to the Child and Family Agency because the child ended up first in hospital with such severe infestation of head lice and also had scabies that the child had become very badly infected, and the blood pressure began to drop. The staff began to get worried that maybe the child was going into septic shock, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners would realise, I mean, that does lead to death. So the child then was put into intensive care, did make a good recovery, but the house was found to be in a very, very bad condition, and the social worker told the court that the mother just didn't appear to understand how serious the circumstances were.
And you make a point about schools quite often acting as where the alarm is sounded.
Exactly.
And we'll talk about that second case as well of a child with head lice and the efforts made by a teacher to track down what was going on.
That's right. I mean, I think people perhaps don't realise that in many instances, teachers are at the front line of child protection in that they're often the first people to see that a child in a school might have problems. The child might be obviously hungry while they're in school, might not be wearing the right kind of clothes, especially in poor weather, and might be very, very dirty, and that can often lead to other children ostracising the child. And if those kind of things are noticed, then the teachers will make a referral to the Child and Family Agency, and that can intervene, usually before things get so serious that the child has to be taken into care. But if children can't go to school for many, many months, as happened earlier this year, then nobody is seeing that child outside of the family. And there was this one case, I'm sure there have been a lot of others, where the teachers were attempting to keep contact with this particular child, were unable to do so. Eventually, when they called to the house, they found that the child had had a very serious head lice infestation and her whole head had been shaved, with her younger sister, who also had head lice infestation, ending up again in hospital with a bad infection. So those things would have been picked up much earlier had the child been able to go to school. And I think it does underline the fact that schools are just so important for child welfare on a whole number of fronts, without for a moment suggesting teachers should be putting themselves in danger, because clearly people are very, very concerned, but this is a cohort of children who are very vulnerable and they don't have lobby groups to try to bring their issues to the fore. I think perhaps we should all try and find imaginative ways of ensuring that they're not at home isolated.
And this is the question of imaginative ways in relation to visitation rights, because you highlight a number of cases where for what might appear to be good and valid reasons as well, visitation has been denied because of perhaps health issues with the child or with members of a foster care family, and visitation from a parent could potentially create a problem during COVID-19.
Absolutely, because the intention when children go into care is that if circumstances permit, they will go home when circumstances at home improve. And the law does state very clearly, both international law and our own, that reunification should be the objective. Now, it doesn't always happen. It can't always happen. Families don't always manage to overcome their problems. But you have to maintain the relationship between parents and children if reunification is to occur. And that is done with regular access meetings between the parents and children. And in a number of instances, these have been cut back or reduced or indeed not happening at all. This will affect the relationship between the parents and the children. It also means that what are called parenting capacity assessments, which assess whether or not the parents will be able to mind the children, they rely to a large degree on observation of the relationship between the parents and the child during access meetings. They can't take place. And it could well jeopardise the reunification of the family if the access meetings can't take place.
Now, as we know, Carl, the precautions that are in place and the lockdowns and so on, these are going to continue to a greater or lesser degree for some time. So do you have any proposals or solutions to put forward?
Well, I think a lot of people are now looking at who the priority workers might be in relation to vaccination. And I think there is a very strong case for frontline child protection social workers and some foster carers, not necessarily all foster carers, but foster carers where there is a health vulnerability within their own household, to be considered for early vaccination, to interfere to the least extent possible with the lives of children in care and to ensure they can maintain relationships with their families.
Carl Coulter there, Dr. Carl Coulter, Director of the Childcare Law Reporting Project. Thank you very much for joining us.
Airline mergers are expected in the months ahead and more airline collapses are likely, a report from PwC concludes. It also envisages that airlines will need ongoing access to emergency liquidity, including government support for the foreseeable future. $180 billion in government support has already been provided to airlines, which the report says has introduced a long-term unlevelling of the playing field. Just under 22,000 companies were formed last year, a reduction of 4% on the numbers for 2019, the latest figures from CRIF VisionNet show. However, startup activity improved as the year progressed, with the figures for the final 3 months up by a fifth on the same quarter last year. China's economy grew at the slowest pace in more than four decades last year, with GDP growth of 2.3%. It represented a marked slowdown on the revised 6% growth for 2019. China is expected to have been the only major economy to have posted growth in 2020 after a strong rebound from the COVID crisis. On the currencies, the euro is trading at $1.20.7 and 89.2 pence sterling.
25 to 9 now. Good morning once again to Darren Frahill.
Hello again, Mary, and some really good news in relation to Breege Stack this morning. She has been released from hospital after hurting her spine in an Aussie Rules game she was playing in yesterday. The former Cork footballer playing for a club, the Giants, it was a practice match against the Crows, and her club has confirmed this morning that she had a stable fracture of the C7 vertebrae, no injury to the surrounding nerve area, so she won't require surgery. She will have to recover, though, and she'll have to wear a neck brace for a little while. She is expected to make a complete and full recovery, and the club have confirmed that she will remain in Australia and will continue to be a key part of the team as she rehabs from her injury. So that is really good news this morning from Australia, and we wish her the best in her recovery, Breege Stack. Good news from the cricket this morning was that Ireland's game against the United Arab Emirates got the go-ahead. Four previous matches had to be postponed last week because of COVID-19 concerns. Not a good start, though, for the Irish team. The hosts won the toss, they opted to bowl first, and they took three early wickets. The Irish team, though, have settled, going really well at the minute. They're looking at the scoreboard here, 184 for 5 after 46 overs. We wonder, though, will it be enough? We'll have to wait and see. Manchester United remain top of the Premier League after a scoreless draw away to Liverpool. Liverpool probably played the better football at times and dominated the possession, especially in that first half, but it was United who carved out the better opportunities. Despite those opportunities, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer delivered this honest assessment after the game.
I don't think we played well enough. We didn't impose ourselves on the game, especially first half. I think we grew in the game, into the game, and towards the end you felt, yeah, it's here for us to win, and we create two massive chances and two brilliant saves by the keeper. We can play better than this. We know that. We can be more composed. We can have the ball more. We had to defend really often. And I thought we gave the ball away too often. So a couple of things that we need to improve on.
Elsewhere, Manchester City 4-0 winners against Crystal Palace. They're now second. Spurs, who beat Sheffield United 3-1, are fifth. Just 4 points separating the top five. It is fascinating at the top of that Premier League. Let's talk about it now with coach and RTÉ analyst Lisa Fallon, who joins me now. Lisa, I know with these big games, Liverpool and Manchester United, we always want lots of goals, but is it time we give a bit of respect and praise to the art of defending?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it's an old cliche that goals win games and clean sheets win leagues. And you know, I think both managers, I know Solskjaer said he was disappointed there, but I think he could probably be really, really proud of the defending that his team did. I think Luke Shaw did an unbelievable job on Mo Salah yesterday. And I think an awful lot of Manchester United fans felt a lot of trepidation when they saw that Eric Bailly wasn't in the squad and that Victor Lindelof wasn't in the team. And Lindelof was, and to be fair, I thought Lindelof, Maguire, Shaw and Wan-Bissaka were absolutely superb in their defensive roles last night, and same for you know, Liverpool, because there was I'm not sure if anyone was really clear about the fact, but apparently Liverpool had a makeshift defence, and I think that message came across loud and clear. But I really thought that Fabinho was outstanding. I thought his positional awareness and his knowledge of when to go and when to move from the position and go with the player was really exceptional, with those little diagonal runs that the Manchester United forward line were trying to make to create some disorientation in that Liverpool defence. So I thought the two defensive performances were really excellent and probably said more about the reasons why the teams didn't score than the forward performances.
Sure. Who do you think would be the happier of the two managers, Lisa?
I think probably, I think Solskjaer probably will on the basis that United probably come away from that game knowing that they had a right chance to win that game. They probably had a little bit of trepidation, and probably I think that result probably gives Manchester United more in terms of belief, in terms of kicking on for the rest of the season, because they knew the game in the second half was there for the taking, and they grew in the game, and you could see the confidence growing, and that's something that's probably been absent. And I think from a Liverpool perspective, there probably was a bit of relief that the game, you know, that they didn't lose the game. So I think for the rest of the season, from a belief perspective, and bearing in mind that Liverpool have this little nuance over them now that they haven't scored in their last three games, and you know they've gone four games now without a win, whereas Manchester United are on the opposite side of that. They had three wins going into the game and they didn't lose. So and they come away thinking it was a game they could win. So I think, you know, it's going to be really exciting. But I think Solskjaer, even though he says he's disappointed, I'm sure the result probably gives more confidence to Manchester United than it does to Liverpool.
And finally, and very briefly, just in a few words, Lisa, City, were they the big winners overall?
They were. Like, you look at the table now, they've that game in hand against Aston Villa that they play midweek, and they win that game and they go top. And I watched them last night. They were such a joy to watch. Kevin De Bruyne, I could watch him all day. The things he can do with a football are just quite exquisite. But yeah, I think, you know, people are all talking about Man United and Liverpool at the moment, and I think that really suits Man City. But certainly they're the ones to watch for me at the moment.
Great talking to you, Lisa. Before I go, racing today is at Punchestown, first race 1:05, and a great win for the 20-year-old Yang Bing Tao beat John Higgins to win the Masters snooker title.
The Garda Representative Association has called for an immediate process to review and reform the Garda Síochána Ombudsman Commission. This is after a Garda was exonerated from charges that included assault, false imprisonment and giving misleading information to GSOC. The charges related to the arrest of a Dublin bus driver 2.5 years ago. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds joins me now with more. Paul, will you fill us in on the background here to what was going on?
Yeah, Mary, this relates to an incident in Dublin City Centre on the 15th of September 2018. Garda Noel Gibbons, who's based at Pier Street Station in Dublin, he's also been a presenter on RTE's Crime Call programme. He was driving his car and making a turn into the Garda station at the time. He drove into the bus lane. Dublin District Court heard that the bus driver, David Stamper, began flashing at him. The Garda got out of the car, and he subsequently arrested the driver under the Road Traffic Act after the driver refused to give the Garda his name or details. The bus driver was taken to Pier Street Garda station, and he demanded to be dealt with by a more senior officer. He then left the station because he was in a hurry to collect grandchildren, we heard in court, and then he went back to his depot but was ordered by his inspector to go back to Pier Street station. Now, he subsequently made a complaint to the Garda Ombudsman about Garda Gibbons. GSOC investigated. The Garda was charged with assault, false imprisonment and giving misleading information to GSOC in connection with the arrest of the bus driver.
And this resulted, did it, in the court case, and now a complaint by the Garda Representative Association.
Yeah, this basically, there was a court case last Friday in relation to this. The case against Garda Gibbons was dismissed. He was cleared of any wrongdoing. The judge, Conal Gibbons, said Mr. Stamper had tried to, quote, create his own rules and procedures. He held that the Garda's inquiries were perfectly legal. He had the power of arrest and he had used minimal force. However, the judge also criticised the Garda Síochána Ombudsman's Commission's investigation and its role in the case. He said that he had concerns over the GSOC investigation and that GSOC had not interrogated the issues properly. And he also said, quote, it's difficult to understand how this relatively minor incident between the Garda and another road user escalated and metamorphosed into a full-blown prosecution.
Did GSOC, the Ombudsman Commission, respond to any of those comments from
the judge? GSOC issued a statement on Friday saying that it respects the decision of the court, as it does in any case, the DPP, but it pointed out that the DPP, the Director of Public Prosecutions, brought the prosecution. The decision to prosecute was for the DPP, and any question on the issue should be raised with the office. Now, GSOC specifically did not address in its statement the judge's criticism of its investigation or that it had not interrogated the issue sufficiently. Now, the GRA then reacted last night, issuing a statement seeking revised protocols and legislative changes, and they say that rank and file Gardaí generally have grave concerns over GSOC. They say they can't understand why criminal prosecutions are being launched in certain cases. Damien McCarthy, who represents Dublin's South Central Division, where Garda Noel Gibbons is stationed, says in a separate incident, two detectives waited 20 months to be exonerated after unsubstantiated allegations of sexual assault were made against them. And now the Garda Representative Association, which represents over 12,000 rank and file Gardaí, has called on the Minister for Justice, Helen McEntee, to meet them to examine current legislation governing GSOC and ensure relevant safeguards are in place to protect members of Gardaí from vexatious complaints.
And any response from GSOC to what the GRA is saying?
No, we contacted GSOC last night, and again they effectively reiterated or reissued their first statement with a second line which said that they were looking for statutory change. It was pending with the Minister for Justice. It looked forward to that legislation for increased powers and resources, but this doesn't relate to any of the issues that were raised by the judge or the GRA.
Paul, I just want to ask you about a separate unrelated case where yesterday over €1 million in cash was found in a car during a search in Dublin. What can you tell us?
Yeah, it's another €1 million in cash. It's the second time in 18 days since the start of the year that the Gardaí have got over €1 million in one seizure. Basically what they were doing, they were targeting a drug dealer in Cabra in North Dublin. They searched an apartment in Raheny, a property in Dublin city centre, and two cars. Now in one of those cars, and it took some time to ferret out the cash because the cash was hidden in the body of the car, and they discovered over €1 million, which was packed and sealed, vacuum packed. The Gardaí say was ready to be moved. They believe it's from drug trafficking. It was the second seizure of the weekend. They also seized €117,000 in cash in a separate operation in Coolock, along with a Rolex watch and a car. A man has been charged in connection with that. He's due in court later this morning. But in the last 18 days, they've seized more than €3 million in cash so far this year.
Paul Reynolds, many thanks for that. 14 minutes to nine.
The EU and the US have both demanded the release of opposition politician Alexei Navalny from Russian detention. Mr. Navalny was arrested by police soon after his flight from Germany landed in Moscow last night. He's being held for breaching his parole conditions. He was returning to the country 5 months after he was almost killed in a nerve agent attack in Siberia. He blamed that on the Russian authorities. Russia denies it. We can talk now to Evan Gershkovich from the Moscow Times. Evan, do we know this morning where is Mr. Navalny?
No, his associates and his allies are still looking for him. They suspect that he's at a police station not far from the airport where he landed, which is just outside of Moscow. And they overnight were taking turns standing outside of that police station in temperatures well below freezing. His lawyer has still not been allowed to see him. She's currently at that police station, and she's been demanding to see her client, and she, as recently as 10, 15 minutes ago, the allies were saying she still has not been allowed to see him. So they're saying they're not totally sure where he could be. They're assuming at that police station, but their guess is as good as anybody's.
Now, the Kremlin has repeatedly described Mr. Navalny as a nobody. Vladimir Putin won't even say his name. Yet the authorities went to an awful lot of trouble last night for someone they describe as nobody to have a hero's homecoming.
Yeah, I mean, this has been the pattern with Navalny for a decade now. He is, you know, the most recognizable opposition figure in Russia. He's probably the only one who can be considered really any sort of threat to the president. And for a decade, they've been saying he's, you know, just a nobody, just a blogger. That, you know, they never mentioned him by name. But then at the same time, yesterday, they shut down any air traffic into one of Moscow's major airports for over an hour. So it's hard to say, you know, at the same time as they're saying that he's a nobody, you don't really shut down air traffic to one of your major airports in the capital of the country for over an hour, if that's the case.
I've heard many commentators in this part of the world describe what happened yesterday in Moscow as a sign of weakness on the part of the Kremlin. Is that fair?
I've been thinking about that myself for the past few days, you know, expecting him to be arrested when he returns. And in some ways, that's not clear at this point. One of the major, you know, moments of the political calendar coming up this year are the parliamentary elections. Navalny is obviously, you know, as the major player, would be able to rally support for opposition candidates running in those elections, to rally people on the streets out of those elections. And if he's locked away, he won't be able to do that. The other point is that despite the fact that he's the most recognizable opposition figure, despite the fact that, you know, globally he's known, at home he has really little support. So he, you know, over the past decade being criticized on state TV channels, not being mentioned by name, He only carries about 20% approval rating, according to independent polls here. And about 50% of people don't even believe that he was poisoned by Russian authorities. So in some ways, we have to see how it plays out, but it could be he could have, you know, just handed the Kremlin an easy victory in this case by, you know, they're able to put him away for 3.5 years, which is what the sentence that he's facing is. It could be just an easy solution for them. Of course, Mr. Navalny himself is facing, you know, an impossible choice, whether if he stayed abroad and becomes a sort of dissident emigre, that's not much help to his cause either. So, you know, he picked, obviously, the more difficult of the two options, and now we're just going to have to see what the Russian authorities do.
Yeah, because if he is put away for a considerable period of time, does the Kremlin have a strategy to deal with that? Because it's been said his supporters, thousands of whom turned out at the airport originally to greet him, would turn him into a Mandela-type figure.
There's obviously talk of that, there's rumor of that, but we do have to remember that his support is quite small. So even in 2019, when we saw big, what we called large protests here in Moscow, when opposition candidates were blocked from balloting in local elections, Navalny was able to rally protests here in Moscow that lasted about a summer. At the peak of those protests, we saw 60,000 people on the streets. In a city of 12 million people, in a country of 145 million people, that is not too significant. The Kremlin really easily handled those protests. They, Russian authorities threw something like, it was about a dozen people in jail for sentences from a year to 4 years. They ended up releasing some people early, not even putting people in jail. You know, sort of the threat of the crackdown loomed over it, and everybody dispersed. So again, it's hard to predict whether there would be such a massive response in Russia to Navalny being put in jail for that long.
Okay. Evan, we're very grateful to you for taking our call this morning. Thank you. Evan Gershkovich from the Moscow Times. It's 8:52. They've called it their field of dreams. The Waterford women's Gaelic football team are the first in the country to own their own pitch. It's an 11-acre site beside the Waterford Greenway on the edge of Dungarvan at Ballon Road. Edel Curry from the Waterford LGFA joins us now. Edel, it must have great views being so close to the Greenway. It's been a long road to get here. Why did you have to do it?
Hi Audrey, how are you? Yes, it was just, it's fantastic news coming through this morning that we are the first ladies county boards to own our own field outright. It actually started back in 2015, so we're going back 6 years ago. A field development subcommittee was formed by the Waterford Ladies Gaelic Football Association. We went back 6 years because there was a need for the pitch in Waterford Ladies. It was our vision at the time to own our own grounds outright. I suppose like every other county board in Ireland, we rely on the men's local GA clubs to use their facilities, and we are extremely, extremely grateful to the GA clubs. But it came to a time whereby we Waterford Ladies just needed to be independent and to be able to hold the likes of their own county finals, to be able to have structure for the county teams in terms of where they're going to train. It was kind of going day to day, week to week. They were traversing the country, not knowing where their next training session was going to be. So back in 2015, what we did was we put together a field development subcommittee. We sat down with our main sponsor, who are LLS Dodge. They've been there with Waterford Ladies with 20 years. And it was agreed that we needed to start a fundraise to start off our plans. I suppose with our field, Audrey, we had to start from scratch. Like, we couldn't go near the main income stream, say, that is needed for the day-to-day running of the county board. We really had to think outside the box. And what we did was we had five fundraisers. We had two race days there at Punchestown Racecourse, two golf classics at the Hermitage Golf Club, and a local dog night here at Kilcone Dog Track. That was the first part of the hurdle. Then the second part was, We're in County Waterford. We needed to find a suitable field mid-county that would suit all of our clubs. So you have clubs the likes of Cumber Rangers up in North County Waterford, Ballyduff Upper, West County Waterford. Locally here in Dungarvan Town, you have Abbeyside, Dungarvan, you have Kilrossany, Brickies, and then move down towards the city, the east, you have Aaron's Own and you have Galtier. So we had to find that mid-county location to make it suitable for all our girls. So yeah, thankfully we did. And we have a greenfield site here just right beside the greenway. So it's one side of the field is the greenway, one side is the road. Girls can travel by bike, walk, car. It's just so accessible.
It really will look brilliant. It will be right up there with any other team and what they have in order to prepare. If the men ask nicely, will you let them use it maybe the odd time?
Of course, I think we more than owe them, absolutely, after years and years of borrowing. Yes, absolutely. It's just fantastic.
It is brilliant, and congratulations, and it's well earned. Thank you very much, Adele Curry from the Waterford LGFA. It's 2 minutes to 9.